By the way, I'll have to, someday I'll have to put, how many of you know who the Duck Dynasty people are? Yeah, I have to put a picture up for you sometime. Their children go to the school where our son-in-law is the coach. In fact, one of the grandsons of Phil is plays ball. They have several of the children go to school there, and so Janet's got her picture made with Willie. I'll have to put that up sometime. So I think three of them were at the Grandparents' Day little thing that they put on there. So, and they dress in their full regalia regardless of where they are. So kind of fun. We are in a series of lessons that I've entitled Worship, the New Testament Concept, and I consider this to be the second half, me delivering on the second half of what I owe you as your preacher here. The first half of it was our study in the book of first eight chapters of the book of Romans to find out that the Bible doesn't teach that you have to be good enough to go to heaven. And even though we all say we know that, some of us say we know it, but we don't really know it. And we have lots of little contrived concepts that we have inherited, many of us, over our lifetime about how a person is made righteous and how they stay righteous. And that needs to be discussed separately because it's one thing. We sometimes get them, we throw them all together in the same mix, about how you get righteous and then how you stay righteous. But once we understand that righteousness is imputed and not earned, once we really do understand that, it changes our life. Changes our attitude about God. Changes our relationship to God. So we've spent, and here in a week or so, I think Janice was telling me that 5 years ago this week is when we closed on our house. So we've been here about 5 years now. And so I've spent about four of those years talking in some way or other about the first eight chapters of the book of Romans, even when you didn't realize that's what I was talking about. And now I'm trying to put what I consider to be the second major installment of what I really want you to know. What I feel like I have to share with you, and that is this New Testament concept of worship. That worship is something much broader than simply what we do while we're here in this assembly. And I have to say this every time I feel like I do, but that I'm not saying that this is not worship. This is worship. This is special, specially designed by God. Be worship, but it is not exclusively worship. Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, is one example of verses that tell us that worship is something more than just what we do here. And so, you can say it lots of different ways, and whatever way helps you quell whatever burning there may be whenever I say this inside of you, then that's fine. The word, the term worship is used in more than one way, like so many other terms in the Bible. And whenever we get hung up on just one understanding of a concept or a word that embodies that concept, then there are some passages in the Bible that we don't understand. And consequently, we tend to gravitate towards certain passages and maybe even use them as proof texts of things. And there are other passages that we just are not comfortable with, and so we just don't focus on those passages very much. And so it ends up that we have our passages and they have their passages and never the twain shall meet. And some of us, hopefully, are finding out that we need to tweak, if that's an acceptable word to you, we need to tweak our understanding. And as we read through our Bibles and study our Bibles, And I know back a number of years ago, this was really, really a hot topic in our brotherhood. And there were people who even divided lines. I'll give you an illustration. I've thought about whether or not I ought to use this or not because it may be, well, anyway, whatever. I'll use it anyway. I've decided. I have a real good friend that is one of our Christian college presidents. And he and I spent lots of time together before he became president of Christian College and so forth. And one of the things that we studied together was this principle right here. And so he became convinced about that and became a part of his thinking, a part of his life and so forth. And so whenever he was being, when it actually passed the interview process and he had been hired, and he's now meeting with the board of directors for the first time, I have no idea how this came up in the conversation, but all I know is that one evening late, I got a call, and he said, "Stegall, you taught me this thing on worship. Now you got to help me get out of a bind I'm in." And somehow in the conversation, this had come up about all of our life being, in a sense, worship. Well, what he didn't know was that at that particular school, that was a really hot-button topic. They had had lectureship around it. And there were some really influential people there who didn't like the concept. And so when and some of them, by the way, were on the board of directors. And so when that came up, and then they lightly, I suppose I would say, challenged him. And so he called me and he said, "Stegall, you got to help me out." And I said, "Well, you got to tell me what you said, you know, so we can start here. I don't know what you said, you know." And it had become such a part of his thinking that, and we're that way, aren't we? We learn something and we see how it all fits so many things together, and we start implementing that in our talk and the way we think. And then all of a sudden, we're shocked to find out at some point down the line that there are some folks that are opposed to this. And so I'm spending lots of time trying to plug holes, because I know that particularly in the past that there has been some opposition to the concept that worship is something more than what we do here. And people make it, they, in order to try to disprove it, then they start accusing, "Well, you're saying so-and-so." Well, I tell you what, how about if you let me tell you what I'm saying? Okay? I'll try not to tell you what you're saying and what you believe if you don't tell me what I believe. And I'll try to give you the opportunity to explain why you believe what you believe. And I would appreciate you giving me the opportunity to explain why I believe what I believe. And you saying that I believe this, and if I believe this, then that means so-and-so, doesn't make it so. All right? So I've said all that to let you know that you need to really be paying attention. And because we're going to, from this lesson, I only have one more thing to accomplish in this after this particular lesson. We started out clearing some ground, and then hopefully we built something on the ground that we cleared out, and now I'm going and trying to make sure that the pieces fit together for you from a biblical perspective. I made some statements initially that we spent 3 or 4 weeks showing that the Bible teaches this, as a matter of fact. And once you begin to entertain the idea of something new or new idea, then you have to test that out for yourself. You have to see if it can fit into your faith system. And if your faith system is big enough to handle that, or if it doesn't, or if there's some reason that it conflicts with your beliefs and your convictions, you have to think about, well, does that mean this? And does that mean this? And you have to do that with everything. In order for this to really become meaningful in your life, it's got to fit really comfortably within your framework of your faith and your convictions and your understanding of the Bible. And we all hopefully realize that our understanding of the Bible is incomplete. I mean individually. Unless you think you know everything that the Bible teaches perfectly, then that's true. And so as we read our Bibles and as we study our Bibles, then we encounter some things that don't just fit real comfortably within our framework. And so we have to try that out. And, you know, if it comes, interestingly, if it comes from somebody that we don't like, we just dismiss it out of hand. If it comes from somebody that we have some reason to trust, then we may not particularly like it, but we will at least hear him out. And we'll be willing to entertain the possibility if he can prove it to us. All right? So that's what I hope that 5 years has done for me, that it has, I have become your friend, and that you know that I, fundamental things that I do believe. And so whenever we come to something like this, then you will entertain the possibility, well, maybe what he's saying is true. And so as we look at the Bible, then you decide this for yourself. We're talking last week, and by the way, from this point on, I will be talking from after this lesson, Lord willing, my plan is to focus on our assembly for about three lessons and talk about the purpose for our assembly. So the things that really concern people the most about this teaching is, well, what does that mean about our assembly, the necessity of it and the things that we do and whether we can, what happens when we do some of those things outside the assembly and so forth. So there are lots of questions about the assembly and what impact this might have on our assembly that you very likely will have. In fact, I'd be a little disappointed if you didn't have some, because to me that would mean you're not thinking very much. So that's what we're going to spend our last weeks discussing. And since I only have about one more week, then we'll shift over to Sunday nights, and I'll finish it out on Sunday nights. Lord willing, that's the plan. We discussed in our last lesson how the early church allowed the concept of Old Testament worship to creep back into this new concept that Jesus introduced. We based much of this, or at least we use as a springboard for this study, John chapter 4, where Jesus told the Samaritan woman that true worship was not going to happen in a particular place, neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem, he said. And then he said, but the time is coming and now is. And by saying that, the time is coming and now is, then we surmise that he's talking about something new. He's not talking about something old. He said, time is coming when neither in this place, which was there on Mount Gerizim in Samaria, where the Samaritan temple was, neither in this place nor in Jerusalem will be the place to worship. So he's saying the place is not going to be important. And consequently, some things associated with it are not going to be what we focus on. But true worshipers, God seeks those true worshipers who will worship in spirit and in truth. And we have traditionally said that means with the right form, with the right attitude. That's what those two things mean. Well, then if that's what he means, then he's not introducing anything new. Because he's always required that it be the right form with the right attitude. And so we spend some time talking about hopefully expanding our idea of what it means to worship in spirit and in truth. And it means something more than just the right way with the right attitude. And so we looked at worship words, the words, some of which came from contemporary Greek society that they would have been familiar with, some of which came from Old Testament Hebrew, which the Jewish people would have been familiar with. And we saw how that those words, when they were brought into the New Testament, were expanded. We looked at passages to show that when they're used in the New Testament, they weren't referring to a particular time, place, and acts. But they were expanded into a life concept. Things like doing good, investing the widows and orphans, And in Romans chapter 12, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God. We talked about the fact that, and we'll reiterate that again today, of what comprised worship. When you had the right place where God dwelled, you had a priest who was God-appointed priest, and you had an acceptable sacrifice. Those are the three things that comprise worship. And we're going to reiterate again today about what those things are in the New Testament concept of worship. But we saw how last time that the early Christian writers, such as Clement of Rome, who was wrote around 95 A.D., began to draw parallels between Old Testament worship and New Testament worship, and how those, because he was such a respected person, him and others, then they planted seeds that began to go back and establish some of the old worship traditions and how it affected the thoughts of the Christian movement, if you will, as it matured in the early days. And consequently, it wasn't very long until they reestablished this special priesthood. They ended up with only certain people who were priests, and they talked about sanctuaries and talked about altars, and even some of those things still carry over to this day where those parallels are drawn. And as the church digressed into the dark ages of ritualistic legalism, then religion became the ultimate means of controlling people. And so it became very, very legalistic. Jesus had warned about that, in fact, as it did happen. And then later there were attempts to restore this concept of New Testament or biblical Christianity. And this Reformation movement of the 1600s was an attempt to reform the religion of the day, which was the Catholic Church. And the Reformation took place. And men such as Martin Luther believed in the priesthood of believers, that everybody was a priest. And that was, at that time in the 1600s, that was a radical thought. In fact, that very thought, that to hold to that one truth, cost people their lives. And the church had become so powerful that they killed people. They burned people at the stake for heresy. And it became almost a witch hunt. And so everybody who was not a total conformist better either keep their mouth shut or be ready to die, because they were going to be persecuted for their beliefs. And so men like Martin Luther restored the biblical concept of the priesthood of all believers. And whenever he posted his theses on the wall, then he was signing his death warrant when he made that public. People like Zwingli and Calvin were men who were in the process, and their goal was to reform the church, the Catholic Church as it existed at that time. And these men, unfortunately, some of them didn't come all the way back. But they made some steps in the right direction. But men like Calvin came up with the acronym TULIP, and there were certain doctrines that he espoused that people still espouse today. That the TULIP was is the right word, an acronym? Use the first letter. Letter. The T stood for total depravity. U was unconditional election. L was limited atonement. I was irresistible grace. And P was perseverance of the saints. And each one of these we can study. That'd be a whole quarter's worth of study right there, to study each one of those doctrines. Then it represented coming part of the way back toward New Testament, our biblical New Testament Christianity. And by the way, I make a distinction between first century Christianity and New Testament Christianity. And whenever I talk about we want to restore the church, I'm not talking about the first century church. I'm talking about the New Testament church. Because as you go to Paul's epistles in the first century and the New Testament epistles, you find out we don't want to replicate some of those churches that were there in the first century, do we? I mean, I certainly am glad that this church is not like the Corinthian church, because those people lived under lots of pressure and lots of difficulty, and there was lots and lots of intense feelings and divisions in that church there, as there was in some others. But it's our intention to restore the New Testament concept of what Christianity is. And so consequently, while we may go back to some of the post and pre and anti-Nicene fathers to read some of their writings, that's just history. We go back to the New Testament and see what the New Testament says, because that's our goal. And so in the 1800s, following the Reformation movement, came the Restoration movement. And Marty has taught a class on this fairly recently, some church history, and those of you that were there know a lot more about it than I do. But the Restoration movement of the 1800s rejected many of the Old Testament encroachments into Christianity, such as altars and sanctuaries and priesthoods and titles and those kind of things. And I want to say that we're very deeply indebted to our forefathers who so courageously broke away from the accepted norms of the religion of their day to take a firm stand on biblical patterns. And I'm not afraid of that word, because that's a New Testament concept, that there is a pattern to be reestablished. We're not married to it in the sense that we think that's our Savior, but we do, it is our goal to go back and become a biblical New Testament church and to restore the concepts that we find in the Bible. And so I want to say to us, and I know that it marks for some of us a difficult transition, it's our turn now. And I'm not sure that we have that concept of ourselves, because I think that it's really a tendency on our part to think, okay, we got to hold on to what we got. We hold on to what we receive from others, and we do. Except we have a responsibility to restore things that need to be restored. It's our turn. And if all we ever do is just try to hold on to the tradition of our fathers, how does that make us any different than the people that Jesus was so upset with in the first century? And so we go back, and I'm not saying change for the sake of change. I'm saying change when we find something that we're inconsistent with in the New Testament. And that's when and where we need to change. And so this attitude of restoration must remain alive in every generation. And I've said that before to audiences and had some people who were really angry at me for saying that, because they believed that we had restored everything that need to be restored, and we just stay right where we are and hold on exactly to where we are. And so they were angry at the idea that we are to maintain this attitude of continuing to restore the New Testament biblical pattern. Or do you suppose that there might still be some assumptions and presuppositions that we have accepted that are more Jewish than Christian? And you don't have to agree that there are, but do you think there's a possibility that there might be? Well, I'm going to at least give that much slack, all right? That there might be some things that we need to look at and find out where they came from. These men in the Reformation and the Restoration movement focused on the who of worship, the how worship, the when of worship, and the where of worship. Now, I'm making a really broad statement here, and you have to put this in your pipe and smoke it, as my mother used to say to me, but see how that fits for you. But they didn't concentrate on the why of worship, because it was always assumed that the why of the assembly, First Day of the Week Assembly, was to worship God. And it was focused on God. As was temple worship in the Old Testament. And we're going to spend 2 or 3 weeks trying to look at the why of worship from a biblical perspective. Go back and look at some New Testament, look at New Testament scriptures on worship. We came to the point that when we thought of worship, we thought of a building and Sunday and Christians who sing and pray and study and give and take of the Lord's Supper. And that became our concept of worship. And it never occurred to us to question why we do these things. Our concept, I'm going to suggest, has not completely broken away from the Jewish system that was the basis. It was from Judaism that Christ came. And so I'm going to challenge you for this week in preparation for our study beginning next week, that you go through your Bible and you just start trying to find passages that are set in New Testament assembly. You go and see how many you can find. First thing you might be shocked at is you don't find a lot. Now, I'm not trying to make a big point there, but we'll work this over in the next few weeks to come. And as you read those and you go back and pick up the context, I want you to ask yourself, what was the focus of that assembly? What were they coming together for? And so you can do a little research on your own in preparation for next time and ask ourselves the question, does our assembly match in purpose and nature what we read in the New Testament, or in fact, is there a possibility that it may more closely match what the Jews did in the temple in the Old Testament? So, I'll just throw that out for your consideration for a week here. But I want to focus now, again, I'm going back, and I know that and I used this phrase one time in the 20s and 30s class, and they stopped me about 5 minutes later and said, tell us what that means. And I always use this phrase, I don't know, I picked it up from being a country boy, but I'm going to go back and re-lick my calf. And, all right, now, how many of you know what that means? I thought Texans would know what that means, all right? I'm going to take a minute and tell you what that means. When a mama cow has a calf, what's the first thing she does to it? She licks it to clean it. And if she didn't do a real good job, then she's got to go back and re-lick her calf, all right? So I'm going back, and I'm going to make sure that we've all got in our understanding. Now, by the way, that ought to be a Texas. Texans ought to understand that. But I'm going to go back and make sure that we're all on the same page with these parallels and talking about the three things that are necessary for worship to take place. And we'll use that as a foundation for our going into talking about our first day of the week assemblies. There are some parallels. Having now said that sometimes I think that we draw more from Old Testament parallels than we do from New Testament concepts and scriptures about what the assembly is and what its purpose is, now I'm going to go back and say to you there are some parallels between Old Testament worship and New Testament worship. And the Bible, particularly the book of Hebrews, is going to talk a lot about shadows and types, isn't it? And it's going to go back and pull some things from the Old Testament, and it will say, this is a type of this. Now, we have to be careful in not making our own types, all right? Because there are some things that may seem rather obvious to us. It seems like it just fits that this is a type of this. Well, if you don't have a New Testament biblical passage to teach that, then be careful in teaching that as doctrine, okay? But we do have a bunch of things that we can go back to the Old Testament and we can know that these were types and shadows of something that was going to be the reality in the New Testament. and in God's kingdom and in the church. And so, once again, what is it in the New Testament that parallels the temple of God, the dwelling place of God in the New Testament? What is it? Our bodies, individually, as Christians. And I think in order to understand this whole concept, we really have to understand these things. And not just say them, not just say them, but think about what that means. Because that has lots of implications if that's true. And by the way, it is true because the New Testament says it plainly, doesn't it? And so let's look at some passages, and you might want to take some notes on this. Feel free to do so. And I will ask somebody, some volunteers, and let me give you some passages, and some of you be looking them up, and then when we get there, we can move through them. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 9 and verses 16 and 17. Let me have a hand of somebody that will read that. You going to read that for me? 1 Corinthians 3, 9, and verses 16 and 17. I need 1 Corinthians 6, 19, and 20. Let me have a bump. You got a bump right here. 2 Corinthians 6, 16. Ephesians 2, 19 through 22. Okay, and we'll get those in just a minute. And while folks, while you're looking those up, or these guys that's going to read them are looking them up. In the New Testament, the parallel to the temple, the dwelling place of God, is not this building. We say it over and over again, don't we? But we confuse, we say it, but then we confuse the issue. We do it in Vacation Bible School, and what's one of our favorite little songs when we want the kids to be quiet? Tiptoe, tiptoe in God's house. Really? And we're trying to tell our kids, this is not God's house, right? But we're telling them, we're saying it's not, but then we're teaching them that it is, aren't we? How many of you can remember, or you were ever part of a congregation where it was just a venial sin to bring a drink or food into this spot right here? Where we assemble. How many of you? Let me see your hands. Huh? Yeah. And I mean, there was lots of churches split over that very thing, wasn't it? That you couldn't bring any food or water into the sanctuary. And all the time we're saying, this is not God's house. Well, why are we confusing the issue? Why don't we be consistent about this? This building is no more holy than your house is. This building is no more holy. And you know why some people make it holy? Because it was bought with God's money. We're going to have to talk again about what God's money is, aren't we? Huh? There have been lots of churches split over what God's money, what's God's money, and how it's, how. I know a guy that he's not alive right now. He died fairly recently. But he had a burr under his saddle his whole life about somebody took some money, some of God's money, and bought watermelons for the kids to eat watermelons. And he stayed mad about that his whole life. And he died mad about that, that they took God's money and bought watermelons with it. Oh, my goodness. You know. And so, the parallel to the temple in the New Testament is us. Let's read our passages. 1 Corinthians 3, 9, and verses 16 and 17. All right.
Verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building.
Okay.
16 and 17. Don't you know that you yourself are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is sacred.
Now, if we didn't have any verse but that, wouldn't that be plain enough? Say that, don't you know that your body is the temple of God? You have, you're not your own, you're bought with a price. God's Holy Spirit lives in you. If that was the only passage we have, wouldn't that teach that? Okay, let's read 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20.
For do you not know that your body is the temple of the
Okay, so what's the therefore, the conclusion of it? Glorify God in your body. We need to think about how we're going to glorify God in our body, don't we? 2 Corinthians 6:16. Ephesians 2:19-22.
Consequently, you are no longer foreigners and aliens, but fellow Christians with God's people and members of God's household, built on the foundation of apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the chief cornerstone. In him, the whole building is joined together and rises to become a holy temple in the Lord. And in him, you two are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit.
Okay, so the New Testament parallel to the temple, God's dwelling place, is what? Us. Right? And the Bible, by the way, some of those passages spoke of us individually, and some of them spoke of us collectively, as a family, as God's temple. Secondly, and by the way, this is a holy assembly, because the holy are assembled. You can let that one soak in a little bit. Secondly, who is the New Testament, or what is the New Testament parallel to the priesthood? I need 1 Peter 2:9 real quickly. Somebody. Don't. John, you got that? You don't? Okay. Give me 1 Peter 2:9. All right.
You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into wonderful light.
Okay. Revelation 1:6. Revelation 1:6. Who'll get it? Come on, don't quit on me now. You got it? Revelation 1:6.
He's made us to be a kingdom and priests to serve the God and Father. Give you the glory and power forever and ever. Amen.
Okay, so who's the priesthood? Who are the priests today? We individually are. Priests were especially qualified men to perform sacred duties, and they acted as an intermediary between man and God. So who is that today? Is it the preacher? No, it's not. There are some folks that look at me as if I am. Your line, your little red line to God, it's just as hot as mine. You have as much access to God as I do. I'm glad to pray for you. I consider it an honor that you want me to pray for you. But my prayers are no more effective than yours if you're a righteous person. Yours are just as hot as mine are. And God is just as attuned to you as he is to me. Is it the elders? Are they the priests? They're not the priests any more than you are. We're all priests. Okay, then one more. What's the New Testament parallel to the Old Testament sacrifice? Well, somebody says, it's right here. This is it. This is my sacrifice right here. I reach in here and I get some money and I put it in the plate and that's my sacrifice. And we make a sacrifice. Folks, that's about 9/10 of our problem. We want to make a sacrifice rather than be a sacrifice. And we think if we make a sacrifice, then we don't have to be one. And we're really, really missing the mark. Because until we see ourselves as a sacrifice on the altar, every day, every moment of every day, then we don't really know what true worship is. But when we see ourselves as the sacrifice, you see, we've read the story and we've heard the story of Abraham and Isaac, and we've always thought we were Abraham. We're not. We're Isaac. We're Isaac. And it makes a big difference in your life how you see yourself. And when the day comes that we see ourselves, Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your spiritual worship, your logical service. And when we see ourselves as a sacrifice, then there's not going to be part of us that's unholy. We're not going to want to be our time and our money and our energy part God and part mine. We're all His. We're holy. We're sanctified. We're set apart. And so we live that way. And every moment of every day is lived with the consciousness, I'm offering myself to God in everything that I do. Everything. There is no part of my money that's not God's. There's no part of my time. There's no part of my talent that's not God's. It's all His. Some of it I spend, actually a very little of it, I spend in corporate worship, in the assembly with other Christians. Most of it I spend out there with my family and with other people and interacting with other people. But all of that time, all of that energy, it's all God's. It's all His. And I offer that to Him because it's His. Actually, all I do is acknowledge that it's His, and then I try to clean it up because I want it to be holy. And then I meant to read Hebrews 9, 1 through 14, so you can write that down and go and read that part. That'll set the stage, Lord willing, for our class next week. Thank you. God bless you.